ready, I believe.
They're all eager. See? The readers here?
Yep.
Good morning. This is Monday, and it is March the 6th. And this is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. We're here with the Department of Education, Dr. Knorr, Mandel, and others. And, of course, Lisa always keeping an eye on things. It looks like you brought Brian Reeder with you today. Good to see you again. Dr. Knorr, why don't you go ahead?
Great.
Public hearing.
We have to open a public hearing on 5516 and 5517. Okay.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. And we are pleased to be in front of you again to continue our presentation on our agency budget. And today we will continue the presentation with the Early Learning Division. And with that, I will turn it over to David Mandel to continue his presentation.
Dr. Mandel, good to see you. Are you Dr. Mandel?
I actually am, but it's okay.
Well, I don't like to call somebody doctor. Dr. Mandel, please.
Chairman Roach, Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director. I just have a little bit left in my presentation, but also wanted to let the committee know that you should be receiving a memo later today with questions from the last session, including some additional information on hub administration expense, matches and maintenance of effort for various federal funds by FTE, efforts to increase supply, and we should have later on the week too some additional information on changes in the supply of in child care markets over the last decade or so. Just to continue on where we were on Thursday, I had been walking to you with the committee through our preschool programs, OPK and Preschool Promise. Both of those focus on children, 3 and 4 year olds. We also know that there's really incredible, important development that happens in the infant toddler years, and that research shows that the quality of relationships between parents and their child during those years sets really the path for well-being and later life success. One of the most critical of those programs for infants and toddlers is Healthy Families Oregon. It's not the only home visiting program in Oregon, but it's the one that's administered by the Early Learning Division, and that is available statewide with 17 Healthy Family Oregon providers across the state. Moms are screened using the new baby questionnaire to identify families with high numbers of risk factors. Those are eligible for home visiting program that focuses on not only connecting children and families to additional services, but working with parents to really develop parenting skills. So children served by Healthy Families Oregon are 2.5 times less likely to be maltreated compared to unserved children. Participating mothers were 13 percentage points more likely to read to their babies on a daily basis. And children whose mothers were enrolled in Healthy Families Oregon are significantly more likely to
co-chair.
Fully immunized at age 2.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Could you go back one slide
to
the service areas realigned in 2016? Could you talk briefly about that?
Sure. That was in part an effort to create greater alignment between our hub system and some of our early learning delivery programs. So we have under the current realignment, we don't have a sort of misalignment of hubs and Healthy Families boundaries at this point. There may be a couple places where there's more than one Healthy Family provider in a hub, but we don't have more complicated situations. So that was part of it,
great,
of that effort.
I figured it had
something
to do with the hubs.
Yes.
Thank you.
One of our other programs that I think I already mentioned a little bit in discussing the education continuum is the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, which was formed in authorizing legislation in 2013, provides $9.5 million that's really focused on building those early learning K through 12 connections. It's resources that are really intended to flow through elementary schools to be working with early learning partners to measurably improve children's readiness for kindergarten, close early opportunity gaps, build local pre-K grade through three systems that create seamless experiences for both adults and children, and develop replicable and scalable models. The focus is on shared professional development, strengthening family engagement, and building seamless transitions to schools. We've had some really, we've been working since its inception with an evaluation team from PSU, and I think what we're finding from the evaluation is really consistent with the intent of that program.
And Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Mandel. Okay, the program was established in 2013, but we didn't get funding till this budget. Is that what I'm seeing? And what are our expected outcomes? Do you have a key performance measure on this issue, and how much was actually given to the hubs? Thank you.
So this is actually the second biennium of KPI funding. So it was funded in the previous biennium. Currently, it's funded at $9.5 million. During the first biennium of funding, not all of the funds necessarily went through the hubs, in part because there were not hubs in most places when that funding first went out. But again, it's not dollars that the hubs themselves are supposed to spend. It's investments through elementary schools. As I was saying, the focus is really on building some of those. So the focus is really, with all of our investments, on looking at that long-term changes in children arriving at school ready to succeed. And when I talk about KPMs, we'll look a little bit about the kindergarten readiness, kindergarten assessment scores. But what we've seen through the evaluation, in terms of, I think, important short-term measures, is really that both an increase in parents feeling confidence in their parenting skills and their ability to have children arriving at school ready for success. So, for instance, parents were asked, one of the questions that parents who participated in KPI-related programs were asked, I'm prepared to help my children after kindergarten. Before the KPI projects, 46% answered positive to that. After that, 83%. And we also see a similar pattern, which is really one of the goals of KPI, of kindergarten teachers both saying that they understand what's happening in child care and early learning experiences, increasing from 55% to 98%. Yeah. And a flip side, kindergarten teacher, early childhood professionals and preschool teachers increasing from 61% to 93%, their understanding of expectations for kindergarten.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebland first, and then we'll go to Representative Wisnett.
So just a clarification. We funded this in the 2013 biennium, the 2015 biennium, and this biennium. It's just that they didn't go through hubs in the 2013 biennium.
Right.
They have gone through the hubs the other
in
two
In the
2015-17
biennium. And so this is the second biennium, sorry.
Yeah, the second biennium. And this will be the third biennium of the funding.
Yes.
Well, and we're asking for the same level of funding this time as we had last time. Did we spend all the money last time?
We did.
Okay.
We did.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass. I'll have I'll request a separate meeting. So
okay.
Appreciate it.
That would be great. I'd be happy to do
Thank
that.
You.
And then one last but not least program I'd like to touch on is the state's investment in relief nurseries. Current service level is $11 million for the upcoming biennium. And again, funding for Oregon's unique system of relief nurseries flows through the Early Learning Division. With the relief nurseries, I think it's also really important that in addition to the general funds and a little bit of federal funds that are passed to them, the relief nurseries privately raise over half of their budgets from local communities. So relief nurseries are community-based nonprofits serving children and families at risk of entering the foster care system with the goal of making sure that doesn't happen. They serve families and children under the age of six who are experiencing risks and stress factors associated with abuse and neglect. These factors, and there's actually 47 that they look at, include substance abuse, mental health issues, homelessness, and families enter the relief nurseries having an average of 16 of these 47 risk factors. The core part of the relief nursery model includes intensive therapeutic early childhood classrooms, home visiting, and parent supports, but they're also prepared to provide, to connect families to other services based on families' needs and also to really address unique family needs as they come up.
I think most critical factor maybe for success, those home visits, those early home visits.
Chair Monroe, Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee, I think when you talk to the relief nurseries themselves, they would really
talk about what's
really successful is the ability to wrap around the whole family, to both provide the direct supports to children in therapeutic classrooms, to the home visits, but also the flexibility to address needs as they come up, to connect parents to mental health professionals when needed, et cetera.
Senator Roblin.
And thanks. This is a very special and unique program in Oregon in the sense that we have this nonprofit organization called Relief Nurseries that has to authorize anybody to call themselves a relief nursery. I've had fights both ways. Talking to my own relief nursery, it took them a long time to get to the place it was. They will admit in conversations that they couldn't have got where they need to be without them. So there's others that have not gotten them, so they're upset because they haven't been able to meet the requirements, basically, of doing that. And I know that we kind of help, but it's really a separate organization. And I want to keep watching because I think what they have provided is really exceptional. And figuring out how some communities that don't have them can figure out how to get there is really important to me because there's this need is everywhere. And so I hope we continue to help guide people so that local places that are trying to do it can get there. And I know that part of it's their funding. Over half the money has to come from community organizations. So anyway, just a comment, any comments you might have with respect to how we continue to work with them would be great.
Chairman Rowe, Chair Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, this is a really great question. So I think one of the things that I forgot to mention is it's also very unique in the sense that the relief nurseries were actually created in Oregon, and it's really a unique model to Oregon. And part of that model depends on the capacity to raise those community funds so that one of the conditions for developing a new relief nursery in a community is the ability to not only demonstrate, working with the Oregon Association of Relief Nurseries, that ability to meet those standards, but also the community capacity to support that local fundraising is really core to the model. And we've been, as the division, really trying to work very closely with the association over the last 5-6 months to work through some of those issues on what that looks like.
Thank you.
Now I want to turn from the programs and just touch really quickly on the governor's requested budget. As I mentioned earlier, the governor's budget does include a POP to make a new investment in the professional development system of the early learning workforce of $8 million. I also really also, and I've covered some of this previously, though, want to call attention to POP 202, the CCDF fund shift for $6.1 million. Again, this is federal funds, and in the end, it's actually budget neutral. What it's doing is shifting funds from transfer to operations to support all of those new CCDF requirements we did talk about. But it does have a real impact on services for children and families. It does mean $6.1 million less that we'd be transferring to employment-related daycare, which would sort of translate into about 349 families having access to employment-related daycare. Part of the CCDF fundship also includes a request to increase other fund authority by $2.9 million. That's to have the ability to collect those fees associated with the significantly higher background and fingerprinting checks that are also part of the new CCDF requirement.
Senator Roblin.
And on that line, I really hope we figure out a way. So we have some of these daycare, their employees are getting paid very little And now they're expected to have to pay another $90 from income that's not there to get fingerprints done because the federal government has required it. I hope we consider that as we continue to move forward so that some of those people, we can figure out a way to aid in some of that kinds of stuff. Because I think it's to push it down onto some of our lowest paid employees in the state is not necessarily the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And then finally, we have one additional policy option package, 203 ELD operations. That's part of the governor's budget, $1.7 million with four FTE. As part of the race to the top, we had about 19 limited duration positions. Almost all of those are going away. The previous previous biennium, seven of those were made full-time, were made permanent positions and were funded one quarter this biennium with general funds, three quarters with race to the top. So part of this is also switching those positions that were already made permanent duration into fully funded by general fund. And this is just what the early learning division's budget looks like with the governor's budget. In terms of what we look at in terms of KPMs, one of the goals of the early learning division has been to increase the number of children that have access to quality and early learning environments. The quality rating improvement system, now called SPARC, has been a major part of that. We've seen a significant increase in the number of programs that are engaging with SPARC. This is really the number of programs that we call commitment to quality or above that have started that process. But that's really important because that really signals the willingness and the interest of providers in the field to engage in that. And as you can see, that's increased to over 1,300 providers in 2016. Oops, sorry. Oh. And that's also translated into...
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Could you go back one slide?
Yeah. Sorry. I keep on hitting the wrong direction.
So I just want to look at, because is your target, was that your KPM from last time?
You know, to be honest,
I was going to say, so really what I'm trying to get to is why was your 2016 target lower than your actual from 2015? That does not seem terribly aspirational in the most respectful way.
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, members of the committee. To be honest, I will have to do a little bit of historical digging to find out that story. My guess is it may have been that those were part of our race to the top targets that were set really early, and those got translated. But let me do a little bit of historical digging. I agree with you that it does not show the ambition that we like to aspire to. Right. But I'm also glad that you can also see that we certainly have aspired to more than that.
Right. And I would also wonder what are indeed your – do you have numerical targets for 17 for this biennium? And I would like to see those, too.
Excellent. Okay. We will come back to you with those.
Thanks.
Senator Roblin.
That was the question.
Yeah. Okay. We're just brainwaving each other.
Mr. Chair, just a reminder, it's this subcommittee that sets the targets for the next set of targets. Based on recommendations, of course, from the agency, but you are the final purveyor of that.
We're going to get a big bite and then that apple.
And this our second KPM related to quality and learning environments is the number of programs that have actually received a rating of 3, 4, or 5. And you can also see there's been a really significant increase in that, and we can come back to you and discuss whether we should have a more ambitious target or not.
At least that one was better than
that one's better, yeah. Mr. Coacher, right, because that one, it was 6% in 2015, so your 2016 goal was 25, you exceeded it. But the point is that the goal was higher than the year before, so that was, thank you, good job.
Okay.
And our, you know, our ultimate goal is really that children are arriving at school ready to succeed. So the kindergarten assessment is a really important tool at trying to assess that. As you can see, you know, and to be honest, this is really, I think, our sort of our long-term measure, and we know this will take a long time to see significant increases. The numbers do seem to be heading in the right direction, although not quite meeting the ambitions of the targets at this point.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Just because the first three are easy to figure out, what is the approach? Can you give me a short summary of what the approach is to learning score is or is made up of?
Chair Smith-Warner and Monroe, committee members, happy to do that. This approaches to learning and social emotional development uses what's called the Child Behavior Rating Scale, and that is a teacher assessment. So it's a questionnaire that teachers don't do right at the beginning. They do a little bit into the school year, so they have enough time to actually have observed the children. It was adopted by the state because there was enough research behind it. It had been used enough in research to both have pretty high documented reliability, but also quite high validity, including predictive validity, in the sense that it has been used enough in research to show that it's actually quite predictive of third and fourth grade later academic success, including reading and particularly math. This is the first year that we'll have had the kindergarten, an entire cohort that will have started in kindergarten and third grade. So we're now going to be able to start looking at our own data a little bit more on those, just to see how those things are correlating. So that'll be just wonderful to be able to share that with you in the future. But it looks at questions like, this student frequently, not so frequently, follows directions, you know, with two steps to them, or things like that.
So it's a little more subjective than the first three?
Yes and no. And to the extent that we actually have quite a bit of reliability data to it, we know that kindergarten teachers, the questions are well enough framed that kindergarten teachers answer them consistently. And there's Great. Data to show that consistency in answering.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
So, do we have any raw data that shows us, because these are the increase in the average number of sounds identified. So we could have 85% of our kids already meeting that, but we're only looking at the increase. So do we have data that indicate how kids are doing, and are we on track with those kinds of numbers, or are we just going to be looking at percentages of increase?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, this is a really great question, and when the state adopted the kindergarten assessment, because this was really both a new kind of assessment with new challenges around it, there was a deliberate decision to not create cut scores from the very beginning, to observe the data and to have more information to work for before deciding whether a cut score or not would be appropriate. So I think that's going to be a question, particularly now that we're going to have the kindergarten data be able to correlate with third grade reading and math, to determine whether cut scores, developing cut scores, is inappropriate at this point or not.
Thank you.
So this is really a KPM for the ODE as a whole, but I think it's really important to, I just wanted to include it because it's really important to think about what are the long-range goals and how do we also really think about the way this links up to things like third-grade literacy. And as I was saying, we're really going to have the first chance this year to look at how the kindergarten assessment is correlating, you know, with these scores and hopefully other things like chronic absenteeism and other data. And then finally, at the request of LFO, we were asked to submit and include in this presentation a 15% general fund cut from CSL. I think, you know, what's the biggest takeaway, I think, is that given that 200 that we have a general fund CSL of $259 million, and that $250 million of that is grants and programs. It's really impossible to do a 15% cut without really impacting children and families directly. You know, if you think about that 153 of that 259 is OPK, to get up to 15%, you really do have to make some program-level cuts.
The last place I want to cut.
So I just wanted to thank the committee for giving me this opportunity, and I'm sure we will have opportunities during the rest of this legislative session to continue this conversation.
Dr. Mandel, we appreciate your presentation, appreciate your insights, and we know that we'll be spending a lot of time together making sure we get this done right.
Thank you very much.
Any other additional questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair. I would like to invite Brian Reeder to join me as we transition into the K-12 segment of our budget presentation. And this is a classroom, actually, from an early learning center in Pendleton. So these are kiddos. They've consolidated their early learning and kinder programs into a single facility, and this is a classroom where you have students very actively engaged with a teacher. All right.
And we're glad that Dr. Reeder is still with you, because some person with some experience in Oregon education needs to sort of hold the rest of you new guys together.
Yes. All right.
Ready?
Yes, please. Yeah. Okay. So let's go to the next slide, please. All right. As I mentioned earlier in my agency overview, that each of the three components of the agency, the Early Learning Division, the Youth Development Division, and K-12, have their independent governing councils or boards that direct their own mission, goals, and objectives. I say this because we are going to present you with a mission and vision statement and a set of goals and strategies. The Youth Development Division will do the same. As I also described, each area, there is a lot of overlap between all these three areas, and we work collectively to address the needs of Oregon's children, students, youth, and families to have success in both education and career, in school and out of school. As you look at our mission statement, we felt that it's really important to have language that addresses equity and excellence, and we believe that those two things go hand in hand. The next part of our budget presentation moves into the services provided to students in our pre-K-12 group. I'll start by providing you an overview of some of the key goals that we have, and then Brian Reeder will walk you through the state school fund over the next couple of days. As I assumed responsibility for my role in July of 2015, I felt that it was really important for me to carefully review, assess, and evaluate the agency goals, the agency strategies, and the direction, and to ensure alignment with the governor's goals and priorities. One of the areas that we wanted to get some clarity on is our vision. What is our vision as an agency, given what we know about education in our state, knowing what's trending nationally? What is important to us? What has the legislature actually deemed to be important? What has the governor deemed to be important? And what do we know will make a big difference in the lives of children as they go through our system? So as a result, we came up with a vision that every student will have access to and benefit from a world-class, well-rounded, and equitable educational system. And I want to underscore both the world-class and the well-rounded. A well-rounded education provides students access to a comprehensive curriculum, and it's not just math and English language arts. It provides them access to humanities, career and technical education, health and PE and music and the arts and a variety of other experiences that we know are part of a world-class education, and we know that are imperative to the development of the whole child. And part of that is also our commitment to equity. By providing a well-rounded education, we believe that we are meeting our equity and responsibility to every single student in our state. As we do our work, we wanted to identify a set of values that helps us that help us accomplish our mission and vision. And these are the enterprise values. And what I mean by that is that these are the values that the state of Oregon, through the enterprise leadership team, which is comprised of all the agencies in the state of Oregon, deemed to be what should be driving what we do and how we do it. So we have four values that define who we are, that help that we carry out in everything that we do, and that is integrity, accountability, excellence, and equity. I believe with integrity, we carry out our work with honesty and transparency, regardless of the situation. With accountability, we own and take responsibility to ensure quality outcomes for all of our students. Through excellence, we collaboratively manage the resources we are entrusted with to achieve the best possible outcomes for all of our students. And finally, with everything that we do, we create and foster an environment where everyone, all of our students, no matter where they are, no matter where they live, where they go to school, that they all have access to opportunity to thrive. Okay. Excuse me. Currently, we are working through the development of our 16-18 strategic plan, which will focus on four primary goals that will be the focus of our K-12 work, especially over the next few, as you hear about them in the next few days. Through the programs and services, you will understand our focus, our priorities, and the purpose for including these key goals. These goals are also predicated on the vision that the governor established. I believe the vision that the legislature has established, especially through its investments over the course of the last two bienniums, and based on state and national data and research that says if you focus on those goals, you are likely to see improved outcomes for all students. So we want our students to start strong, and you heard about the Early Learning Division and the Early Learning Division's work and the investments that the legislature has made to improve outcomes for students and to bridge gaps and to increase opportunities as students prepare to enter our system. Within our K-12 framework, we also have services such as the Early Intervention and Early Special Education programs. And the goal for starting strong essentially is to make sure that kids enter the K-12 system with all of the assets and all of the benefits and all of the supports and resources that will help them be successful and be on track by third grade. We know that third grade is a predictor for success within K-12 and beyond. As students transition within our system, as they go from preschool to elementary to middle to high, and as they transition from high school to that next step in their life, we want to make sure that those are smooth transitions. We want to make sure that we know where students are relative to their emotional, social, and academic development, and that we're providing them the supports that will help them transition successfully, but be successful at that next step, whether they go from elementary to middle school. And the work that we do around content standards, the work that we do around assessments, both in class and summative assessments, are designed to give us a sense of where those students are, but the interventions that teachers provide on a regular basis and the other school staff, the counselors, etc., are really critical to make sure that we know where students are along this continuum. And we know who our students are, most importantly. The schools that have achieved the greatest success with graduation are the ones that will tell you, we know who our kids are. We know where they are. We know what challenges they're facing, both in school and out of school, and we've mobilized supports and interventions to help them be successful. And the third goal is really making sure that students graduate college and career ready. And that has two components, in my opinion. One is graduate, and our goal is to make sure that our students graduate on time. And on time means within a four-year time frame, because that's really what a high school is, but recognizing that we have many students that need more time, and some students need less time. So we need to design a system that is personalized, that's individualized, that allows students to move at their own pace, if you will, at their own rate. And for those students that are able to graduate in 3 years, fantastic. Those that need a little bit more time, we are prepared to support them. And most importantly, regardless whether students graduate in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, or six, we want to make sure that they are prepared to transition to that next step in their life. And that could be directly to the workforce, or it could be to a community college, a career school, or a university. We know for a fact that the great majority of our students that are entering freshman students at our post-secondary institutions require some form of remediation. So our goal is to work with our K-12 partners to make sure that students have the actual skills that will help them navigate post-secondary education and those skills that will help them be successful as they enter the workforce. So These are really key goals, and we believe that they encompass all of the work that we do as an agency. And we wanted to capture big, broad goals like this so everybody sees that they're a part of it, whether they're the ones who are doing the accounting, whether they're the ones who are actually doing the first face-to-face interaction with schools and districts. We wanted to make sure that our staff at the agency felt that they own these goals, that they're part of these goals, and that they're contributing to the success of each and every student in our state. Lastly, one of our goals that we felt is really important to have is outstanding customer service, and that is both for internal and external purposes. We wanted our staff to have positive engagements with the various departments and elements of the Department of Education. We want our customers, who ultimately are our students, but the service providers to our customers, which are schools and districts and communities, we want them to have positive interactions and experiences with us. And we are taking every step we possibly can to make sure that we deliver excellent service on time with the help and support that it would take in order for us to be partners and to help our local schools and districts be successful. Our next slide is really our current service level budget. Rick spoke to the current service level budget in the entire agency overview. This is the K-12 segment of it, if you will. Our K-12 public school services represents nearly 96% of the entire agency budget, of which, again, the state school fund represents approximately 3/4 of the budget. And Brian is going to walk you through the state school fund with all of its intricate elements and facets, if you will. There is a total of 394.47 FTE for the K-12 public education segment in our 2017-19 budget, which is a 4.47 FTE less than the level in 15-17. So this number represents a reduction of nearly 4.5 FTE from the current biennium. This slide is a more detailed breakdown of the K-12 budget. And as we, especially as we move through this budget over the next 5 days or so, this is essentially an outline of the presentations that you will hear. We will start today with the biggest portion of our budget, which is composed of the first two items, the state school fund and the common school fund, in which Assistant Superintendent Brian Reeder will go over that. The next 3 days will actually be about the other programs and services that we provide as an agency, and that presentation will be done by Sarah Drinkwater and Don Huckabee, our Assistant Superintendents for Student Services, Teaching, Learning, and Assessment. I will be joining them for that presentation. And then we will close with Rick Krager finishing up on the K-12 services with agency operations and debt service. So this is what we have mapped out for you. Next slide, Brian. For the next few days, and we look forward to your questions and to providing you all the information that you need. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian to walk you through the State School Fund and the Common School Fund.
Welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Smith, Warner, and Monroe, members of the committee. I'm Brian Reeder. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at the Department of Education. For the record, I'm not a doctor, although I have a daughter who's a nurse. Maybe that helps. So I want to walk you through the state school fund, how that fits into our overall funding of K-12 education in Oregon. To start out, here's the legislatively approved budget from the 15-17 biennium as a starting place, about $7.4 billion from the lottery and the general fund, and a small amount from other funds. And then the current service level for the coming biennium, 17-19 biennium, the budget you're working on right now, a little over $8 billion, again, 94% from the general fund, about 6% from lottery, and a small fraction from other funds. Here's the overall state level of funding for K-12 education. At the current service level
in 17-19. You can see the $8 billion from the state school fund and then the other components dominated by grant and aid programs that flow through the state, youth correction, school for the deaf, and so forth, early learning division, and the common school fund. I'll talk a little bit more about the common school fund because it's unique in the sense that it flows to districts and then becomes local revenue when it gets in the funding formula.
I was going to ask, what's the total of that?
You know, I think we didn't add this up. If you go back to Salam's slide here, I believe it's the 9.9.
It's the 9.97. Okay, yeah. That's what I was thinking.
So the basics of the state school fund, in dollars, it's ODE's largest program, obviously, because all of the state school fund flows through the department. It represents about 80% of, when you add local revenue to make up what we call formula revenue, it makes up about 80% of all of the money that school districts and ESDs have, the other 20% coming from federal sources and some other state and local sources that do not flow through the funding formula. The goals of the formula are to equalize district and ESD funding, and in this case, by equalize, we do that on the formula does that on a per-weighted student basis. So for each what we call weighted student, or ADMW, the formula gives roughly, and by roughly, we'll see a little later, there's a couple reasons why some districts get a little bit more or a little bit less money per weighted student. But in general, districts get about the same number of dollars per weighted student as every other district in the state. That's the equalization of the formula.
Yeah, I've often said that since Measure 5 passed in 1990, that there's relative equalization in terms of operating funds, but absolutely none when it comes to capital needs. I mean, total inequity there. So maybe someday we'll attack that as well.
Mr. Coach.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Reeder and or Dr. Noor, you may want to talk about this. I'm new to the education, new 13 years to the education system in Oregon. We talk about maintain local control. Do we get down closer to what do we mean? What decisions should be local, what should be state, and how do other states, do they follow the same example as far as local control as we do? Thank you.
Sure. Co-chairs Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Wisnett. In Oregon, what I believe we mean by local control is that virtually none of the money that we send out to school districts based on our funding formula has any strings attached to it. They can spend those dollars any way they choose. Now, obviously, there are state requirements of things they must do, but for formula money, which flows into the district's general funds, none of those dollars, to my knowledge, have any strings attached at all. They don't have to spend at least this much on these programs or at least that much on other programs. That they have almost complete discretion over how they allocate resources to different uses once they have those dollars.
That follow-up. Thank you. Again, product of public schools, and when I was young, my parents just paid the taxes. We didn't talk about the expenditure of our funds means it's not just how much we give them, it's how it's spent. The state gives 70% of the funds that go to, I've heard school districts beg me to to do statewide collective bargaining, which influences what money we give them to. I had locals beg me to get rid of the current insurance policy where they could save millions of dollars statewide. Do we overuse, and should this legislative body, maybe not the agency, get more involved in how the money is spent than always say, well, it's local control. We give them the money, and you go spend it.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Wisnant, not to avoid answering your question, and we will be collaborative partners with whatever the legislature chooses to do, and we believe we have a responsibility to implement whatever laws and policies the legislature chooses to adopt. I want to talk a little bit about what else is meant by local control, because in addition to the financial aspect of this, there's some programmatic aspects, and I'll share with you how we differ from other states. So in Oregon, local control means that the districts choose the curriculum that gets implemented in classrooms throughout the state. The districts choose the textbooks that the teachers use and the programs that the teachers use to implement their literacy program or their science program or their math program. We do this in collaboration with them by identifying a list of approved items to choose from, but ultimately the district decides what to do in that case. The districts negotiate their own collective bargaining agreements and contracts with teachers. They negotiate all elements of that, from health care to working conditions, et cetera. In other states, what I can tell you is that these areas are more prescribed by the state level, and they vary dramatically from state to state. So other states dictate the curriculum that gets used, including the textbooks that get used in every classroom, in every subject area, at every grade level. They also dictate, if you will, the pacing guide, meaning that all teachers are supposed to be at this place in the curriculum at this time of year. They are more prescriptive in terms of what schools ought to look like in terms of the start of the day and the end of the day and all of these elements that are typically negotiated through a collective bargaining agreement. Some states do not have a statewide collective bargaining agreement, but they have a statewide salary schedule, for example. I believe Washington is one of those states that has that. Texas is a state that has that as well. So each one of these configurations has its pros and cons, if you will. And I believe it's really important to think about what's important to us as a state, what will work most effectively for us as a state to maintain that balance between state and local control. So that's all I will offer at this time. We're happy to come and talk with you about some additional information that we could provide or that we may be able to provide.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may respond, we'll have to have a drink or a beer and do it, but off the record. But that worked for President Obama. But when I came in this building 13 years ago, I think Senator Monroe and Arnie and Senator Rogan were here. The hot thing on the newspaper and everything was how we had some ESDs that were having some issues, and I couldn't understand how Department of Education's role was in that, and I guess it wasn't. But it was very controversial issues of buying airplanes for the ESD to fly around there to visit their things and things like that. So I appreciate your comments, and we'll just have to schedule that beer meeting soon.
Okay. Senator Roblin and then Representative Parrish.
And one of the things that you didn't mention that is near to my heart and I think dear to Mr. Reeder's heart is the fact that every district can decide which program they use to do their accounts and their keep records of their records. And so when we had to build the different databases that Mr. Reeder works with, they had to go and figure out the number of spaces for each identifying issue so that the numbers could be transferred over into that, which doesn't make for easy deals either. There are places, I believe North Carolina, some others, where the state buys the system and says everybody uses the same system, because then the data that comes in we know is the same because each field has its own definition and whatever. We've got districts making decisions based on what it costs, on which program they're going to buy, and then trying to figure out how to make it match the requirements for field length, size, and whatever that are going to go to the state, which is really frustrating at times. It was certainly frustrating for our district. Mm-hmm. And we were thankful that the Eugene district was nice enough to let us buy into theirs because it got us cheaper, and it was one of the bigger ones. But I don't know how many systems, Mr. Reeder, do we use now in our state?
Co-chairs Smith-Warner and Monroe, Senator Roblin, we're down to three or four at this point. And I will tell you that as we've progressed from those early years in our when we went to more formal and consistent definitions and what we call our chart of accounts for the financial data and the student information systems for the other data about students, that the I believe the data has gotten better and better over time, and we're to the point now where I have far more confidence than I used to in the data. So, yes, it's gotten much better.
And I personally want to thank Mr. Reeder for all the work that he did to help that happen, because it was not an easy task, and I certainly appreciate the work that's been done.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I want to follow up on Representative Wisnett's question, because the local control thing, I mean, we it's interesting because we hear that sometimes and it's good, and then we hear it sometimes depending on what the bill is and it's bad. My biggest concern, and I think we've had some of this conversation before, is that the state, who is the larger funder for public schools, can give money based on the school formula, and we understand that, you know, Johnny is in a school in Portland Public, and he gets his basic weight, and then he gets some additional weights for other services that he needs. But nothing that we do then requires Portland Public or some other school district to actually use those dollars in that classroom for that student. And I suspect that some of the issues we're seeing around graduation and keeping kids in school are that that money is not flowing to where it's needed, and it is sort of more being applied as a postage stamp across that district. And to me, that's problematic. If we're saying that there's a student in this school who has this weight and those dollars don't get to that child, what is the department doing to go back to those school districts and say, the state of Oregon gave you 70% of your funding, how did you use it, and did those dollars actually reach that child? Because I actually, and I've asked for public records from school districts on this, certain districts, and I have not gotten those records in the last few years, because I don't think they can properly account for it. And if we're not holding them accountable and those dollars aren't reaching that child in, for whom it's we've intended it to go to, then that's a problem. And I think it is a prolific problem. I can't prove it because I can't get the records. But what are you all doing to make sure that when we allocate those funds, they get to the kid who we're asking them to go to?
Co-Chairs Smith-Warner and Monroe, Representative Parrish, the short answer is, given what the law says, we don't have the authority to force them to use those dollars for those students. So without legislation, we simply don't have the authority to do that.
And colleagues, I will happily get you the LC opinions, but to fix this problem, it will require a constitutional amendment. It is based back in a very ugly part of our history about who we did or didn't want to educate, and if that was how our common school funds and our education funds were designed 160 years ago, and that's what's happening today, I think it's an equity problem, and I think it's an issue that we have got to find a way to make sure if we're going to allocate those dollars, we are holding school districts accountable for how they're spent, because right now we're not, and we see the outcome in our graduation rates, we see them in our dropout rates, we see them in the remediation side of what's happening in our community colleges, and it's a problem, and we're spending a lot of money to not get good results. And I think this is really where the issue lies, is that we're a 70% funder, and we're not getting the outcomes that we need. And I think it's because that money is not getting to the child for whom we'd intended it to go to.
Senator Rowland.
So if we go back and look at the history of who we intended it to go to, that has to do with the development of the formula. It is not 150 years old. It's only about 40 years old, I guess, now. And it was a distribution formula, not an allocation formula. It had nothing to do with allocating that money to those individual students. It had everything to do with making sure that every school district got their whatever they thought would make the allocation come to them more or less. And it distributes the money for the school districts to do with as they wish, and that's why we have no authority there. So if we want it to be an allocation formula, then we really probably have to have a whole new conversation, because in the conversations that took place when I was new in the education system, so it's a little older than that, and the battles went on, it wasn't about how much money it takes to teach that particular student. It was how much money am I going to get as a school based on the kids that I have. So if we continue to have conversations about an allocation form, which we never intended to have at the time we did it, then we need to go back and have that real conversation about an allocation formula. We had a distribution formula that basically said, here's how the money goes. We expect every school district to use it to the best of their ability to solve their own problems. And I think that it's our problem. It has nothing to do with the Department of Ed. It has nothing to do with anybody else. It has to do with the legislature deciding that's what they want to do. So it doesn't go back to the formation of the country, the state.
I will get you those documents,
okay.
Senator.
Like,
I will get you them.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I appreciate Representative Robin, because he's been out in the trenches. But when I came in 13 years ago, I was told, and Senator Monroe better maybe knows about this, but the school distribution formula was passed as a temporary measure. We were supposed to look at it. And it was a negotiated formula based to get all the school districts to sign on. And there were things that should have been looked at. But you know, the problem is, I've learned in 13 years, anytime you change it, Gene, you're going to have winners and losers. And Brian's told me that, and everyone else has told me that. But I think we need to, it is time that we need to get a step back. These gentlemen know I worked 4 years trying to say, if you send extra money for students in poverty, I want to know how it's being spent. And I got the same response from school districts that the senator said. And I think it's time that winners and losers, the winners and losers we're creating are students, and not the school districts. It's winners and losers, and we need to maybe look at this. I firmly believe that our dropout rate, our absentee, and our lack of graduation is because of students in poverty and ELL students.
Senator Roblin.
I won't disagree with some of that. If we get up to the quality education model, which was a research model that said, here's what you need to spend to get those outcomes, let's have that conversation. I just think that right now we have limited assets, limited availability of money to do all the things we've told them that we want them to do. And until we get real about that, we can argue about this all we want. And I have no problem having those conversations. I've never had a problem having those conversations. But we need to recognize that if we want the outcomes that we say we want, we should look at it from a scientific deal. And I think the only scientific method we have out there to do that is the quality education model. So when we start saying that's what we're going to fund at, then I think we can have a better chance of telling districts what they should be doing with it. That's just my opinion.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to thank Representative Parrish for bringing this topic up. One of the reasons why I ran for the school board was because we were receiving $16 million for ELL students and only spending that I could find at that time before I ran, $8 million of it for ELL students. so this is an issue that I've been following along. Maybe you can quickly or briefly mention some of the ELL reform conversations that have recently happened in legislation in terms of how to hold school districts accountable to making sure that they are actually providing the resources in which most folks assume it's intended for them.
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Hernandez, really two things. A number of years ago, probably more than 10 years ago now, I did an analysis of how much money each school district gets through the formula for ELL students, what we call the ESL weight in the formula, and then also based on their audited financial reports, how much they were spending for programs for those students. And what we found is some districts were spending more than they got through the formula for their students, and some were spending less. That stirred a discussion, and we've done considerable more analysis of ELL students since that time in cooperation with Oregon State University. And we now have each year, and I think we just published the second one recently, that does that thing I did 10 years ago each year to show how much each district gets through the formula and how much they spend. And we still see a wide variation. Some districts spending less than they get, some spending more. We are reminded by the districts that reporting the dollars spent on their students isn't easy, because they do it in essentially two ways. One is formal programs for those students, and then one is the extra help that they often get from their teachers in math class or science class, whatever class it may be. And trying to divide a teacher's time and therefore resources between an ELL student in a math class and a non-ELL student in a math class, you know, do you allocate 10 more dollars a day because the teacher spent two more minutes a day with that student? So that's a hard part of the accounting. So we need to take those data with a grain of salt. What I would say, though, and it goes back to what used to be called the tight, loose approach to school funding, which is we're loose on our requirements of placing specific requirements on school districts of how they'll spend their money, but we're going to be tight on our expectations of their results. And I think we've seen that. If you look at our graduation rates, if you look at the ELL graduation rate as a group, those are only students who were still in ELL status when they entered high school. It doesn't include all those students who were ELLs in earlier grades and exited because they were considered proficient. If you look at the graduation rate of students who are former ELLs but exited before high school, their graduation rate is among the highest in the state. It's higher than white students. Yes. It's higher than the general student population taken as a whole. So we're seeing some great success with ELL students who are becoming proficient before they get to high school. Now, some of them that are not proficient in high school are ones that came to Oregon or came to the U.S. when they were already in high school, and so they have a lot of catching up to do, but if we can get them proficient earlier, they're showing great success at graduation. Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Monroe and okay. Co-Chair Smith-Werner, if I may just add to Representative Hernandez's question, a response relative to most recent efforts to clarify the expenditures with regards to our English language learners, and that would be House Bill 3499 that was passed that was passed last session and is being implemented this biennium. Through that piece of legislation, we're able to achieve better clarity relative to definitions as who is an EL English learner, what is the appropriate time frame to achieve proficiency, and we've been able to get to some agreements on that. We're also we also worked on identifying appropriate expenditures that can be supported by these funds as part of the EL plan for the district and the state. And we also were able to clarify the reporting code so we can track expenditures more closely than we have before. So we are making some progress in that regard, and that will help clarify how those resources are being spent and allow us to track them more closely. We'll talk more about House Bill 3499 when we get into that programmatic aspect of our presentation, and we'll be happy to provide you some additional information about the implementation of that program. Thank you.
Okay, why don't we move on?
Okay, a little bit more about the details of the funding formula. Department of Education staff runs the formula and calculates the amount of formula funding that each school district and ESD is entitled to. That's both the local money in the formula as well as the state money that's in the formula. There's also a smidgen of federal money in there, which this is the federal timber money that flows to school districts. And so once it's in their hands, we consider it local revenue in our formula. Mm. So the way the formula works is we calculate how much total formula money each district and ESD gets, and then subtract the amount that they've raised locally through their local resources, and then the remainder is paid to them by ODE from the state school fund. The formula revenue, about just shy of 93% of that goes out based on the number of weighted students that each district in ESD has. The remaining roughly 7% is from transportation grants, what we call carve-outs. transportation grants, the high-cost disability grants, and the facility grants are the major ones that vary from district to district based on their circumstances. But by and large, the bulk of it goes out based on weighted students. And we'll talk a little bit more about those weights in a few minutes. And then by statute, 95.5% goes to school districts and 4.5% goes to ESDs. So you can see here the state and local shares that went into the through the formula in the 15-17 biennium, 33% from local sources and 67% from the state school fund.
Real quick.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Reeder, do we have a chart you can give us or look how's the local revenue? Is it going above inflation or is it on a steady incline?
Co-chairs Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Wisnett, I do have a graph coming up here soon.
Thank you.
That shows that, yes. Here is a breakdown of the sources of local revenue that flows into the formula. It's dominated, obviously, by local property taxes. The federal piece I talked about, federal forest fees, less than 1%. And then a couple of other sources that really originate as with the state but are then allocated to school districts, the Common School Fund, and revenue from state timber. The state timber revenue is of particular interest because it is allocated to school districts where the timber cut actually occurs, and some of those districts are quite small, and that revenue in certain years can be quite large. One district in particular, the Jewell School District, gets no state money through the formula because their local revenue, primarily from timber, is so high. And we'll see that in one of the graphs as well.
Senator Roblin.
So that's one of the things that it's hard to, you couldn't put it on a graph. Basically, school districts get their state funds apportioned based on this, which has different inputs from different places. So like you were just saying with Jewell, it gets so much from the timber, it doesn't get anything from the state. You've also got the federal forest fees, which because of the way we do it now, they're allocated to a particular district again, but then you get less money from the state fund. So the equalization is done at the state level with every school district getting, and so we've had conversations at least in forest counties that say that was intended for those counties to be over and above that, but we have taken that and said, sorry, it doesn't go that way. It comes out as a allocated so that everybody gets pretty much the same amount of money at the end of the day.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, that's exactly right. And the way I think about the formula, and I think this is useful, is that it really is taking all of that money, the state money, those small pieces of federal money, and the local money, and putting it in a big pot, and then saying to each district, based on the number of weighted students you have, this is how much you get out of the pot. And at that point, the distinction between local money and state money doesn't make much difference anymore. It's one big pot of money.
And from the perspective of that, just follow up. There are places that have much higher property tax rates and much bigger property, and so those states help subsidize places that have low property taxes, as well as those that get forest money subsidize those that don't. So it equalizes all of those things, which makes it difficult sometimes when we have conversations at a local level about raising property taxes to be appropriate to the statewide level, because we do just as well. If we raised them, it wouldn't help us much.
So here's the graph that Representative Wisnett asked about. This shows the breakdown in formula revenue by state and local sources over time. And I take this back to 1990-91 because that's pre-Measure 5. back when the shares of funding for K-12 were just the reverse as they are today. It used to be about two-thirds local and one-third state. It is now the opposite of that, and the two property tax limitation measures that we implemented in Oregon really drove that reversal of those shares. You can see that as Measure 5 phased in between 1991 and 1996, the local share dropped pretty dramatically, and the state share grew pretty dramatically. And then you can see the little blip up in 95 or in 96, 97, and then that as Measure 47 and Measures 50, I guess. Measure 47 was never implemented. Measure 50 was implemented in its place.
Yeah.
The local share headed back down for a couple years as Measure 50 was implemented, and then has been rising steadily, and that's the impact of the 3% growth in assessed value that is allowed under Measure 50. So that local growth is a combination of 3% growth on existing property and the inclusion of new property that's brought onto the tax rolls.
How does the fact that some districts, usually wealthy districts, by a popular vote, have actually supplemented this with additional property tax revenue?
Senator Monroe, those dollars don't flow through the formula.
Right.
Those dollars are all kept locally, and so they aren't reflected in here, in this graph. But for some districts, they are substantial. We've got a couple dozen school districts in Oregon now that have local option property taxes that they've passed. Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, a number of others have passed local options. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Also, we have a state grant program that's associated with those.
Yeah, because generally those are wealthier districts and maybe not the ones that really need it the worst. Senator Roblin.
So the thing is really clear here, which is kind of interesting, is that property tax is a much more stable tax. It grows at a stable rate. It doesn't have, it doesn't show the influences of our downturns we've had traditionally. And it also shows that the last couple biennium, our growth rate from the state fund has been much higher than the property tax one because we've reinvested in schools. And so if you looked at that from a linear growth perspective, state funds have kept up with the local revenues, as it looks like to me. It might even be a little bit higher.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, it's hard to say whether they've kept up based on this graph because of all the variation. What is clear to me in this graph is the recessions that show up as dips in state funding for schools because obviously statewide revenue has an impact on what's available to allocate to various uses, and schools clearly is one of those. You can see the recession in the early 2000s,
yep,
and then some fairly rapid growth up until about 07-08, and then it goes flat, and Oregon's revenue structure is such that there's a bit of a lag between when a recession starts and the impact on our revenue. But then you can see it flat for 5 or 6 years as we very slowly crawl out of that those recessionary years of the about 2007-2008. And then as things start recover, then the amount that the legislature has allocated to K-12 through the state school fund grows pretty rapidly in those last two biennia. So a little bit about the Common School Fund. This dates back to statehood. It really was a chunk of land set aside to generate revenue for schools in Oregon. State Land Board oversees those school lands. I won't go to this in a lot of detail, but they have some criteria for how much of it they are going to distribute and how much it will stay in the principal of the fund to generate further revenue in the future. The distributions in 2016 were pretty high, and those really are outside the control of the department. Those are distributed out to school districts. They show up as local revenue. So in a sense, they are allocated across districts the same way any other formula revenue is. So it's truly a statewide sharing of those revenues, even though they are tied to specific land.
And the whole issue about the sale of the Elliott Forest and so on gets mixed up in all of this. Senator Roblin?
And that's what I was going to ask. We had 3.4 million acres of land upon entrance. Do you know how many acres there are now in the state?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, I don't. I don't. The issue with the Elliott is that it was not generating any revenue. It was actually losing money in terms of management costs being higher than revenue, and so that was the impetus for the proposed sale.
And at this time of morning, we're looking for a proper place to break for until tomorrow. So
okay. Well, maybe student demographics is a great place to break because we're headed out of funding sources and into a little bit more detail. So I'm happy to stop here.
Thanks, Mr. Reeder. Yeah, that looks like a good spot. Anything further from members of the committee? Senator Roblin?
We have a lot of educators in the building today. It's an education day. So I know I saw some OSEA members of my district. There's some other people sitting in the audience, and I think it's nice to just recognize that they're here today. And I think everybody from each one of your districts is going to have people around today.
We all have meetings scheduled, I'm sure, with many of them, and that'll be wonderful. And looking forward to that on my calendar. Anything further? I'd like to thank every member of this committee once again. I consider it the strongest committee in the legislature, especially when it comes to education and probably the most important. So with that, we will be adjourned until tomorrow at this time.
Thank you. Thank you.